get to chapters 4 and 5, and this is the junction at which Shantideva has kind of painted a picture, this beautiful vision of responding to the suffering of all beings, you know, this very lofty, elevated vision. And he now gets to the point where he thinks, oh dear, now I've got to do it. And the whole of the first section of the first part of chapter 4 is him sort of encouraging himself to sort of not just quietly park that as a bit of a kind of wild idea, you know, in a very inspired moment. And he's sort of trying to sort of rally his energies and kind of encourage himself, and I guess us, to actually kind of follow through on this kind of, you know, heart-stopping challenge, really, that he set himself and in a way all of us. So this is the junction between what we say we want to do and our aspirations and commitments. And one of the ways of describing the structure of the Bodhicharya Vitara is in terms of the paramitas. Paramitas mean kind of go to the other shore. And Dhammashalin and I debated whether we would structure the whole retreat around these, and decided against it because, in a way, a lot of other approaches to the to this material uses those, and we sometimes use them in level 2 courses and so on, as I think Shantideva's done a course on the paramitas and so on. So in a way it's kind of the obvious way to divide things up, but we didn't want to do it like that. We wanted to spend, well, yesterday I think it was lovely to have a whole day on the bodhicitta, sort of spend more time on kind of mindfulness and awareness, which we're going to do today. So the paramitas are generosity, ethics, patience, vigour, virya, some of you will know that word, dhyana, meditation, meditative absorption, and wisdom. And we'll be bringing these in a little bit in the afternoon sessions, and we're going to do a day on wisdom as well, the day after tomorrow. But in a way, those messages are relatively straightforward from, or more straightforward really, from the text. So Shantideva starts with some extremely strong metaphors. So there's lots of energy, there's lots of passion in this text, and maybe it's that's one of the reasons why it's such a popular text and why it's kind of so engaging to study. And it's all about a struggle between those temptations which pull us to act out of our smallest selves, our smallest minded selves. And he does use this metaphor of kind of struggle and battle, and we're going to kind of look at that in more depth later, because it's such a challenge. It's a very challenging metaphor, really. And it's a metaphor which doesn't kind of quite chime with our kind of contemporary narrative about what to do with the bits of our minds which aren't quite, you know, not quite how we'd like them to be, or how we would, aspects of ourselves which weren't quite like that. Anyway, I'll come back to that later. So it's not surprising that the Bodhicharya Vitara now focuses most of its attention going forward on how to actually put the vision that's been painted into practice. Because you could say that being a bodhisattva is par excellence the Buddhist in action. You could say that it was a very sort of action-orientated angle. And action, interestingly, these two chapters, action starts with working with mental states. I think as a young woman, when I started to sort of think about what to do in the world, what to do with my life, I think I saw at that point that it was all about learning skills and gaining knowledge and being able to offer skills and knowledge to the world. I assumed it was kind of about a skill or a kind of knowledge base, but actually what Shantideva is saying is it's a lot about taming the mind. It all starts there. That's what it's fundamentally about. So this vow to save all beings starts with rooting out the poisons in our minds of greed, hatred and delusion, and very much with energy and persistence. And the text is saying, well, with these good conditions, you know, we have pretty good conditions, it would be a waste not to do that. What a tragedy it would be if we don't use these amazing conditions. And possibly even more so in this time compared with Shantideva's time, you know, the amount of kind of leisure and relative comfort we have, what a shame it would be. But our inspiration degenerates and we become negligent. And Pema Chodron, I'll kind of name check this book a bit because she's got some good stuff to say about this topic, and I'll give you a reference for some specific pages in this later. But one of the ways she puts it is that possibly the biggest threat to good happening in the world is not the explicit action of evil. It's that more that the majority of us lose sight of what we believe in or intended to do. I just think that's a really interesting way of looking at it, that we get distracted by our compulsions. We waste time until it's too late. Most of us don't get up in the morning and think, oh, what nasty thing can I do today? But I can say for myself that I start off with a kind of big vision, and then I get lost in the trees, you know, in the brambles, in the weeds, of my sort of tiny little tasks, and then perhaps, you know, lose the energy flow a bit, lose the plot a bit. So the titles of these two chapters do vary quite a lot in the different translations. Sometimes chapter 4 is called awareness or attentiveness. Sometimes it's called vigilance. Sometimes chapter 5 is called vigilance, or guarding the mind. And it's reminiscent of the Buddha's last words, Appamardena Sampadeta, which meant with mindfulness, with vigilance, strive. And actually those words have got quite a lot of energy in them. You know, vigilance is not a sort of floppy, laid-back sort of word. You know, it's more like a kind of cat guarding a mouse hole. You know, it's more like that. And very much from an ethical point of view. And striving is an energetic word as well. And in the Pali, the opposite of this vigilance, sometimes helpful to sort of define in the mirror image, the opposite is negligence or intoxication or lack of awareness. So the opposite of that is what we're talking about in these chapters. And it's a lot about guarding against unskillful action, by making sure that the attacks, and he uses the very best language, as I said, the attacks of the kleshas, in other words, greed, hatred and delusion, pride, wrong views in the sense of that Dharmashala explained yesterday, they don't happen. And that's in order to stay true to the bodhicitta. So I thought maybe it would be useful to boil it down more on a sort of day-to-day level. So you know when you've been on retreat, most of you, and you've experienced a really positive state of mind, and you've reflected on your life about how it could be different, and you've even identified a few sort of things you're going to change, and a few precepts and kind of you know, promises you've made to yourself. And then you have to go home, and within a few days you've lost touch of how that positive state of mind actually felt, and you begin to wonder what it's all about. Does that make remind anybody of anything? Definitely resonates with me. So it's that kind of thing, it's that kind of sort of degeneration of your intention that's being talked about here in relation to the bodhicitta. And And obviously, when we're involved, this is why the value of the centre and our regular groups and our weekly get-togethers and all the things we do at the Buddhist Centre, you could say all of that is in order to sort of keep our inspiration sort of lifted and maintained and refreshed in between those times of more intense practice as we're doing here. So this chapter is about ethics. This is where Shantideva goes into the kind of ethics paramita, but he doesn't mention a great deal about that specifically because he's focusing on mindfulness in the sense that the mind creates the unethical behaviour. So abstention from overtly unskillful action is a way of having an effect on the root in the mind. So to put it another way, we work from the external manifestation to the internal motivation. And the intention is always to affect the source and the root, which is the mind. So that's a very different way of looking at ethics from the one perhaps we were brought up with, which is about trying to do the good thing and trying to follow the rules and trying to be seen as a good person. This is looking at ethics from the point of view of practicing as if we have the mind of the Buddha, in order to refine the mind, to train it, to be able to make that natural choice. But in the meantime, most of us need some discipline to maintain those precepts, and this is what this is all about, and the awareness of the mind is really key to that. So Pema Chodron uses the metaphor of mindfulness as like a sentinel, like a kind of guard that notices when we wander off. So it's not harsh and judgmental, it's more like a protector. So that's another way of looking at it, that we're placing mindfulness as a kind of protective ally at the gateway between our action and our mind. So going into a little bit more detail of the chapters then. So there's so many ways I could pull this out, so many different things you could take. And actually I keep reading these two chapters in different translations, and I keep kind of, I'm sure it didn't say that yesterday. You know, like this really great stanza kind of jumps out at you. And you think, gosh, you could have had a whole morning around that. Why didn't you see that before? So chapter 4 starts with this reflection on having made this huge sort of promise to all sentient beings. Shantideva has his "oh no, what have I promised" moment and tries to give himself a bit of a pep talk in a way. You know, now you're not going to slack down from it now because, you know, think of the consequences. And talks about the precious opportunity of this life and this birth, and when could it happen again? And this is the point where that very famous metaphor comes up, where the turtle, you know, the one with the likelihood of being born as a human is the likelihood of a turtle poking his head through a ring if he only surfaces once every 100 years. I can't remember the detail, but it's something like that. If a turtle comes up once every 100 years, and what's the likelihood of him putting his head through one little circle floating in the water? And then a lot of the rest of the chapter is about the power of these negative mental states: greed, hatred, delusion, pride, wrong views, deluded views, doubt and distraction. That's another implication. And then the fourth theme in this chapter is this warrior-like determination that spiritual life is vigorous and energetic. And he brings in all these metaphors of the battle, which we'll come back to, as I said. And then Chapter 5 is about the importance of mindfulness. That's its main line of reasoning. It's got some rather quirky bits at the end of it, I must say, which seem to be pulled out of the monks' kind of rules for living, the Vinaya. You can probably find your spittle and your toothbrushes, when thrown away, should be concealed, and it is wrong to foul with urine public thoroughfares and water springs. Actually, that's a really good bit of advice. Considering this was at a time when they wouldn't have known about infection and contamination. Do not sit upon a horse, on beds or seats, with women of another house alone. All that you have seen or have been told to be offensive, this you should avoid. Not rudely pointing with your finger, but rather with a reverent gesture, showing with the whole right hand outstretched, this is how to indicate the road. You know, these really little nuggets of etiquette, I guess. Kind of like medieval etiquette. They're quite funny. But there's also in this section some really fabulous evocative metaphors, including my favourite metaphor of the whole, I think, anywhere in Buddhism, which I'll say in a minute. The first one was, there's one that says, the wandering mind is like an untamed elephant, and it causes more havoc. When we tame our mind, we tame all threats and problems, because all suffering and fear comes from the mind. So that's a very kind of classic teaching, isn't it? But with this this image of this rampaging elephant sort of crashing about. Now this is my favourite one. Okay, I've loved this since I first heard it, maybe 20 years ago. Where is their hide, as in leather? We might make this a vegan version, call it rubber. Where is their hide to cover the whole world? The wide world can be covered with hide enough for a pair of shoes alone. Where is their hide to cover the whole world? The wide world can be covered with hide enough for a pair of shoes alone. And I just found that so kind of comforting. You know, I don't have to try and make it all right out there. I don't have to navigate my world by, nervously peeking around every corner, hoping that there isn't going to be something terrible lurking. I was a profoundly anxious child, just by the way, just to kind of put that in context. There is a way to work. Where you can simply protect yourself from the pain and anguish of life by in this case through awareness and through practice of the precepts. And through mindfulness and through being able to work with mind states. You can't make your life so pleasant by changing external circumstances, and my goodness, I have tried every possible which way. You can't change your external circumstances so you can experience pleasure all the time, but you can control your mind when it comes up against unpleasant circumstances. So that you don't, you're not kind of blown about you're not sort of sucked into the sort of turmoil of that. You can smooth the relationship, in other words, with the world by working with the mind. So there's another metaphor in this section which I wanted to pull out. And I'm looking at Zen here because actually he's the kind of exemplification of this. So the metaphor is, just as a wounded man in the middle of a rough crowd guards his wound with great care, we need to guard our mind in bad company. So you know when you've got, like when I did the same thing as Zen's done to his collarbone, you know, and I was wandering around in a sling, and being jostled in a crowd or in a bus, you know, you're sort of like, you just don't want anyone to come near you. I don't know if you're feeling that at the moment. So I'm like, no, no, not going near that at all. So Shanti Deva is saying, you know, that in a way we're always, our mind is always very sensitive. And if we put ourselves in very sort of rough and harrowing and unconducive kind of circumstances, you know, for long periods of time, I'm not saying kind of be precious about life, but, you know, just bear in mind that if you overexpose yourself to sort of unsupportive conditions, that is going to be harmful. That is not going to enable you to work effectively with the mind. Just as a wounded man in the middle of a rough crowd guards his wound with great care, we need to guard our mind in bad company, putting that in inverted commas. So bad company, I suppose that I interpret that as, you know, people who just don't share anything about, don't share any values or don't respect the values that that we try to live our lives in alignment with. So yeah, being aware of the sensitivity of your own mind, and when your mind is vulnerable, and when you move into social situations, notice that that can be dangerous. So yeah, so mindfulness, serving the body and the mind in every moment, and we need to actually put this into practice and not just talk about it. So. The final metaphor right at the end of the chapter, Shanti Deva says, when we are sick, he so nails it. When we are sick, what use is it just to read a medical textbook? So yeah, it has to be lived. So that's a bit of a broad overview and a few details of these chapters. And there's two themes I wanted to pull out. These are strategies, discipline strategies, you could say. And when I first looked at them, I thought that they were quite different from each other. But now I've thought about it a bit more, I'm beginning to wonder whether they're in a way two sides of the same coin. But anyway, it'd be interesting for you to see what you think. So one of them is very high energy, and this is this warrior energy. And we're going to look at this first, and What we're going to do is I'm going to ask Richard to read these. I'm going to give you all handouts of this text, and both texts actually. And then when you've got those, I'm going to invite Richard to read the text. And then I'm going to have a go at paraphrasing it. And then I'll set up some questions that we can look at in small groups. And we'll have a reasonable amount of time. And they're on this board as well, so you'll have a reminder. And then we'll come back together and just kind of wrap up that section, and then we'll have a tea break, and then we'll go on to the other theme. So that's kind of where we're heading. So, if you could hand out these, and you've already got this, so you'll know where to find it. It is the version, so it'll be exactly matching your version. So if you take one and pass the other box around. So when you're ready, Richard, give us these seven verses.
Warrior Attitude, 428, 438. Anger, lust, these enemies of mine are limbless and devoid of faculties. They have no bravery, no cleverness. How then have they reduced me to such slavery? It is I who welcome them within my heart, allowing them to harm me at their pleasure. I who suffer all without resentment. Thus my abject patience will displaced. If all the gods and demigods besides together come against me as my foes, their mighty strength, all this would not avail to fling me in the fires of deepest hell. All of the foes that I appease and wait upon will show me favours, give me every aid. But should I serve my dark defined emotions, they will only harm me, draw me down to grief. I will not leave the fight until, before my eyes, these enemies of mind are all destroyed. For if, aroused to fury by the merest slight, incapable of sleep until the scores are settled, foolish rivals, both to suffer when they die, will draw the battle lines and do their best to win. And careless of the pain of cut and thrust, will stand their ground, refusing to give way. No need to say that I will not lose heart. Regardless of the hardships of the fray, these natural foes today, I'll strive to crush these enemies, the source of all my pain.
Yeah, so it's very sort of, isn't it? So yeah, so verses 28 and 29. So he's saying that enemies like greed and hate don't have bodies to attack me, and they're not brave, they're not intelligent. So he's wondering how do they enslave me? How do they make me their slave when they don't have bodies and aren't particularly impressive? But still they strike me down from inside my own mind. And then he says, why aren't I furious about this? You know, why am I patient with that happening? So it's completely inappropriate to be patient with being attacked in this kind of a way. I should be furious. So verses 33. So human enemies can't send me to hell, but my enemies, the Kleshas, as I've said, greed, hatred, delusion, pride, doubt, wrong views, they can send me there in an instant. Human enemies become friends if you treat them kindly, but when we're kind to these mental states, they cause us even more suffering. So then he says, I'm not going to rest until these enemies are struck down in front of my eyes. And then he makes a comparison with worldly warriors. They are passionate to kill their enemies. They don't count the pain from the blows and injuries and weapons and things. They won't give up until they win, and they proudly show off their wounds and scars. So why, when I'm fighting, I, Shantideva, I'm fighting for this great cause, for this very sort of beautiful vision, why, when I'm fighting for that, when I am trying to battle these real enemies, the enemies of my mind, the real causes of suffering. Why do I shy away from a little pain? So that's kind of the gist of that. So here's the thing. We're often encouraged in Buddhism and in you know, self-help therapeutic models of working with the mind to be kind to all aspects of ourselves. You know, the famous guest house poem where, you know, like, welcome all these mental states in and be kind to them and show them respect and so on. And all of this kind of, you know, it's sort of a contemporary narrative, really, that we kind of include all of these difficult mental states and give them some love and feed our demons and all these kinds of things, even the most unlovely of them. But Shantideva's telling us that if we're kind to these mental states, they'll just cause us more suffering. So it's like, the reason I pulled this out is actually it's sort of a bit, it doesn't quite chime with some of the other things that we're often teaching. So I wondered if in your small groups, in twos or threes, however you like to arrange yourselves, you might want to think of some examples of any times when you're using this slightly more sort of, this kind of energy, you know, Manjushri Shri's, you know, waving sword. Do you use those kinds of energies when you're working with mental states? And I can think of a couple of examples for myself just to kind of give you an illustration. So one of them is called When Hannah Rescued Me from the Chocolate Fingers yesterday. So my biggest lack of discipline is around sugar, you know, the sort of addiction of sugar. And in many people's cases, maybe that's just a bit of a sort of cheeky habit, but in my case, my blood sugar's a little bit high, not diabetic, but it's a little bit high, so actually it's really bad for me to have sugar. And I sort of decide, it's not like I never eat sugar, but I just decide how much and when I'm going to eat it, and then I stop. And anyway, there were those very cute little chocolate fingers lying there yesterday. And I looked at one, and I thought, oh, just a bit. I'll just, like, break a little bit off the edge. But it had gone against my precept is not to eat sugar when just casually like that. So I just kind of said to myself, kind of quite firmly in my own mind, kind of like, no. You know, it's just like, no. And then, mercifully, Hannah came along, and I said, Hannah, eat that chocolate finger, because there was one left. And I said, Hannah, eat that chocolate finger, so I'm not going to eat it. So Hannah obliged, very willingly, very self-sacrificial. And then she picked it up, and then I saw another one was lying underneath. So I said, Hannah, eat that. And she did. But, you know, that kind of no moment. And sometimes another habit of mine, which is also quite harmful, really, is a kind of self-criticism sort of line. You know, you should have done that better, it's doing it not enough, you didn't this, you didn't that. And sometimes I just turn to it and just go, shut up. Just shut your mouth. And it sounds harsh, but actually that just feels like I just kind of need it or something. Yeah. So anyway, I just wonder if you can think of some examples. So I've got some questions here. So can you think of any examples from your own experience of using that more sort of a warrior energy? Are there any dangers in this approach? You know, it's a very energetic approach. What do you think? It'll differ for all of you. You know, you all might have different kind of conditioning around this. Do you think there's a danger in this kind of approach? And thirdly, are there any dangers in the opposite approach of being kind of kind and accepting and allowing of unskillful motivations? So, you know, are there sort of risks at either end of the spectrum? You might even want to look at whether there's a kind of middle way or some sort of blend or some sort of combination, I don't know. But,